And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's been 8 months since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, displacing hundreds of thousands of people and destroying the legendary Spirit of New Orleans. But it has been 8 months, and by now, things are beginning to return. But not many are saying returning to normal. We talk with two people who have been there, one doing research on the remnants of the sludge that became concentrated on virtually everything, and another who fled the flooding and now is back. It's a special report on post-Katrina New Orleans when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
New Orleans braces for a catastrophic blow from Hurricane Katrina overnight, as forecasters predict that this Category 5 storm could drive a wall of water over the city's levees. The huge storm, packing 160-mile-per-hour winds, is expected to hit the North Gulf Coast in the next 9 hours and make landfall as a Category 4 or 5 hurricane Monday morning. The National Hurricane Center reports that conditions are already deteriorating along the central and northeastern coast. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin declared a state of emergency Sunday and ordered a mandatory evacuation of the city. "This is a threat that we've never faced before," Nagin said. "If we galvanize and gather around each other, I'm sure we will get through this." Nagin estimated that nearly 1 million people had fled the city and its surrounding parishes by Sunday night. Between 20 and 25,000 others who remained in the city lined up to take shelter in the Louisiana Superdome, lining up for what authorities warned would be an unpleasant day and a half minimum. That's how it came to us. August 28, 2005. 8 months later, with at least 1,300 deaths and epic destruction of an American refuge that attracted crowds of people who like to live a bit beyond the normal boundaries, there has been very little good news about the return of life to New Orleans. Today, we visit New Orleans to get two first-hand perspectives on how things are progressing. Last time we talked with Daryl Malik Wiley of the Sierra Club, he was talking to us from outside his hometown of New Orleans, not knowing if his house was standing or what his future might embrace. He joins us in segments 1 and 2, now that he's back in the city, trying to make sense of a very complicated situation. And in segment 3, we talk with Dr. Gina Solomon, who works with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, as she reports on the situation on the ground, literally, and on the walls as the toxic sludge that covered much of the city for weeks dried up and left some nearly insurmountable challenges for those who must now face rebuilding their lives in New Orleans or their lives somewhere else. It's information you need to know. So, as this is a special edition of the Wildside News, we begin the show as always with the news, then move on to our special field reports. So first, the news. As gasoline prices exploded, so too the reactions by many Americans who find the mundane responsibilities of going to work or running kids around to school becoming unaffordable. With his popularity plummeting to record levels, President Bush this week outlined his plans for combating the staggering price of gasoline.
First thing is to make sure that the American consumers are treated fairly at the gas pump. Americans understand, by and large, that the price of crude oil is going up and that the prices are going up, but what they don't want and will not accept is manipulation of the market. And neither will I. Federal Trade Commission is investigating whether price of gasoline has been unfairly manipulated in any way. I'm also directing the Department of Justice to work with the FTC and the Energy Department to conduct inquiries into illegal manipulation or cheating related to the current gasoline prices. The FTC and the Attorney General are contacting 50 state attorney generals to offer technical assistance to urge them to investigate possible illegal price manipulation within their jurisdictions. In other words, this administration is not going to tolerate manipulation. Second part of a good plan is to confront high gasoline prices is to promote greater fuel efficiency. And the easiest way to promote fuel efficiency is to encourage drivers to purchase highly efficient hybrid or clean diesel vehicles, which, by the way, can run on alternative energy sources. Third part of the plan to confront high gas prices is to boost our supplies of crude oil and gasoline. It makes sense. We're in a supply and demand world. If prices are high, it means demand is greater than supply. One way to ease prices is to increase supply. One immediate way we can signal to people we're serious about increasing supply is to stop making purchases or deposits to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for a short period of time.
Critics point out that although the president was beginning to understand that real alternatives are becoming imperative, albeit a few years too late, nevertheless, the changes outlined could make a difference in gasoline prices, although not in the near future. The president also, over the weekend, made a startling announcement that hydrogen was the fuel of the future. To which I say, then, Mr. President, let's get on with putting Americans to the task of creating the hydrogen future in the next 5 years. Over the past week and a half, two reports of humans being attacked by wild black bears are generating a lot of media frenzy about bears. To find out what we need to understand about bears and humans, we go to the source now. You're heading out to find a bear, is that right?
Yeah.
And you got a group with you?
Yes.
What, a school group or something, or what?
There are people from various parts of the country, part of the Black Bear course.
You study bears, you work with bears, you're trying to educate people about bears, and as a matter of fact, you're on the way to find a bear, to track down a bear with a radio collar. What in the world are you doing?
What we're studying is bear conservation in their increasingly urbanized environment.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We're learning what makes nuisance bears and how can people better coexist with bears.
That is a challenge because we're stepping on each other a bit more than we used to.
Yes. Yeah, people are moving into bear country like never before as baby boomers get to the age where they have discretionary income. And the technology generation is establishing home offices in the forest, working by email and fax. Huge move into the forest.
Where are you calling from?
20 miles from Ely, Minnesota, in northeastern Minnesota.
Well, that's wild country up there.
Absolutely.
As you say, I bet it's becoming a little more suburbanized or something like that.
Yeah, all the lakes are being developed.
Wow. Well, part of the thing that's generating this this conversation is the fact that, strangely enough, over the last week and a half or so, there have been two attacks by black bears on humans. And,
yes.
Of course, then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, everybody's out there telling people they shouldn't go to the woods and shouldn't take a hike and shouldn't do this and shouldn't do that because they might get mauled by a bear. What do you think is going on?
Thank goodness these kinds of things are rare. I mean, okay, two attempts like that, or one successful, happened in a short period of time here. But overall, black bears have killed 57 people in the last 100 years across North America. And to put that into perspective, for each person killed by a black bear, there's like 13 killed by snakes, 45 killed by dogs.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 120 killed by bees and about 240 killed by lightning and about 60,000 homicides for each person killed by a black bear.
Right. It does help to use those numbers. Well, you're a guy who spends time with bears. Tell us about bears.
I started out, and for my first 20 years of research, I had a great fear of bears because I grew up with the same brainwashing that everybody else does. I read the outdoor magazines and saw the ferocious covers. I went to museums and saw bears mounted with this unnatural snarl on their face that I've never seen in the wild. and I'd go to national parks, and I'd get handed warning literature that I did not realize was generally written by attorneys to avoid what they perceived as liability problems. It took me a long time thinking bears are unpredictable and ferocious, looking for somebody to get. And when I would see any blustery, threatening-looking behavior on bears, I thought, yep, I know what you're trying to tell me, and I'm out of here. It took me a long time to realize that that is expressions, usually just ritualized displays of the bear's own nervousness. And when I began to interpret their behavior in terms of their fear rather than my fear, I was starting to get it right, and eventually I was able to get the confidence of wild bears to the extent that I could put collars, radio collars, on the bears without using tranquilizers, and that led to me being able to walk with them, sleep with them 24 hours at a time. And now my graduate student, Sue Mansfield, does the same. Mothers with cubs, doesn't make any difference, and I've never had a problem.
Well, now, what's that process of quote-unquote befriending a bear, a wild bear? We're talking about wild bears, and of course we always have to put that caution that this is something being conducted by people who are knowledgeable, have real experience, understand bear behaviors and communication, and therefore, when you're out there, you have an idea of what's going on. You don't want to walk up to a wild bear and just start doing silly things, because that can definitely get you in trouble.
In fact, it'd be extremely difficult to do that with a wild bear, because the first hurdle to overcome is to have them not run away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you generally see. The bears that become killers, like is in the news now, the one that killed the 6-year-old girl, that's one black bear out of a million. I say that because there's about 750,000 in North America, less than one death per year, 57 in 100 years, and that comes out to one in over a million.
And that's really important to keep in perspective. That's almost nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, for the person who unfortunately is attacked, it's everything. I'm with you. It fascinates me how animals and humans actually learn to cohabit. For example, I spent a couple of summers up in Yellowstone, and talk about interaction of people and animals and wildlife. This was grizzly bears and black bears, every kind of conceivable animal, and somehow they managed to get along. But tell us now, as you're really studying this interaction of people and bears, what are you finding out? What should people know?
Well, they're not the ferocious animals we once thought they were. And as what helped me to get over my fear was learning their language.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
And they communicate basically on three levels of intensity. The lowest level is their grunts and tongue clicks. Those are the amiable sounds they make towards each other. Mothers make the grunts to their cubs. Tongue clicks means they want to join another bear for friendly purposes. And then the next higher level is when they, often with some body language, like lunging towards a person and slamming down their feet and blowing explosively, that's the vocalization, blowing sounds mean the bear is nervous. And when I see any bluster, I feel safe, because it means they want to talk about it. I've never seen a bear show bluster and then attack.
Now how,
it means they're basically afraid.
Now, how do you respond to that behavior?
Actually, I basically ignore it. One of the big misconceptions about black bears is the idea of never get between the mother and her cubs.
Right.
And that's a grizzly bear trait. 70% of the killings by grizzly bears are by mothers defending their cubs, but I don't know of anyone who has ever been killed by a mother black bear defending her cubs. In fact, on this project, if I see a family group beside the road, I just hit the brakes, run after them. They flee, usually the mother in the lead, and they go to the nearest big tree. If I'm close enough behind them, I can grab the cubs off the side of the tree. They're in my hands screaming.
Mm-hmm.
That makes the mother upset. I expect a bluff charge, but I've never been touched.
Mm.
They're just not ferocious animals that we've been led to believe by the outdoor magazines, the taxidermy, and all the warnings we see.
Well, what's a safe way to, and of course all of these are qualified, but what's a, as humans and bears come into closer proximity, we're finding them in our backyards, in our front yards, in our houses, and everywhere else. You know, what is the best way to try to what's the vision here of how to cohabit with bears? Because I'm with you. I think there's actually capabilities of getting along with these creatures to some extent.
Well, whether something is a problem or not depends on the person's attitude. If a person sees a bear going through their yard, to some people, that's a major problem. To others, it's the joy of their day. As we mentioned, you know, everybody's been moving into bear country, and the attitude of these people is going to determine the future of the bears that live around them. If their attitude is they're going to do what they want with their garbage, and if a bear comes to eat it, they'll shoot the bear, then their impact on the land is as large as the amount of land it takes to produce that bear. But if they're moving into bear country because they like wildlife and seeing a bear is a pleasure, well, then their impact on the land is no bigger than maybe the size of their yard, which is insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Now, if for example, let's say that you come home and in the backyard is your bear and he happens to be trying to tear into something. Let's say he's smelled something in your garage or something, and they can tear through things. What's the best way to try to stop that behavior?
Well, I would just be aggressive towards the bear and pepper spray. If anybody feels uncomfortable walking in bear country, pepper spray can be the great equalizer. That can make you king of the forest because it works as well on bears as it does on dogs. Mm-hmm. They don't go away mad, they just go away.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I've been in the woods myself walking along and have a bear and cubs and myself have kind of startled each other. We somehow managed not to know that we were going to run into each other.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, they have their behaviors. What are human behaviors that will communicate to that bear that there is no harm intended and the fact that we can just kind of get along with each other and not get along. I'm not trying to suggest that we should sit down and have a talk, but I mean to say that we're just, there is no aggression intended.
I get asked that question a lot, and I've read all the warnings that are out there. I've got a huge file of warnings. It gets down to basically it doesn't make much difference what you do. Because all the warnings suggest that if you don't do it that way, you're going to be attacked.
Good point.
Truth is that you're not. You hear speak softly and back slowly away. And I like that because it shows respect for the bear. And if a bear is there, it would want more space, so that's a nice thing to do. And then you hear, whatever you do, don't run because it could trigger a predatory response. But the truth is, just about the most common story I hear is, I saw a bear, I ran one way, the bear ran the other. And I don't know of any instance, and I've asked many of the people who write these warnings about, you know, don't run because you might trigger a predatory response, do you know of any instance where this has ever happened? And I've yet to come up with the first instance.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you hear is, don't look the bear in the eye. They could think of that as antagonistic and attack. Not true. That's somebody sitting behind a desk extrapolating what they think about dogs.
Well, I think we learned that from Davy Crockett.
Oh, okay. Stare down a bear?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, we already knew that one then, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly.
And then people say, well, if a bear was close to me, I would be attacked because the bear would sense my fear. Well, that's something conjured up out of a person's own mind. They're afraid that the bear would attack, and that's what they perceive that the bear is out there looking for somebody vulnerable that they could attack. The bears are not looking for somebody to attack. 999,000, you know, except for the one out of a million. The truth is, just about everybody who finds themselves near a wild bear is afraid. And they're not attacked.
Actually, bears have a rather interesting diet. They're not really stalking and killing as much as people might think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, basically vegetarian, eating a lot of fruit, nuts, insects. They're not very good predators. They're not built for predation.
Mm-hmm.
They have these blocky bodies that are built for retaining heat in the winter, built for strength, bending branches and turning over stones. But not agile like a wolf or a cat for catching prey. They have more of a mind of a prey animal than that of a predator, and I think that comes from their living for hundreds of thousands of years right here in North America alongside such powerful predators as saber-toothed cats, American lions, dire wolves, and the giant short-faced bear. Black bears wouldn't have stood a chance against any of these predators, but they were the only one of them that could climb trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so they survived by staying near trees and developing the attitude of run first, ask questions later. And you could ask any hound hunter today, he'll tell you he can chase the biggest black bear with his littlest hound.
That's interesting. Now, you spend time, real time, with bears. At any particular time, how many bears are in your region that you're tracking and paying attention to?
Oh, there's probably one per square mile, and we're studying how these bears coexist so well with the rural community here scattered through the woods, so well that there has never been a complaint of nuisance behavior officially lodged, which is really noteworthy. If people want to really learn more about bears, this black bear course that we have here at the Wildlife Research Institute in Ely, they can find out more about it on the web at www.bearstudy.org and click on Black Bear Course. What we're heading out now is there's 8 of us heading out into the woods to home in on a radio-collared bear that has become accustomed to having people walk with it. It's a mother with cubs. My grad student, Sue Mansfield, walks with this bear every day. And we're going to join this bear and just watch how they live. There's two nonprofit organizations here, the Wildlife Research Institute for Bear Research, and then the North American Bear Center, which will open in May 2007. And that has an award-winning top educational site about bears, www.bear.org. And that is an organization that right now is looking for people to put their names onto exhibits that we're going to have, educational exhibits about bears.
One more detail. What's it like? What's the weather like up there in Ely right now?
It's beautiful right now. It's probably 63 degrees with partly cloudy sky and calm wind. The grass is coming up, and some of the forest plants, at least, are not in flower yet, but coming up.
Yeah.
And that's providing the main food for bears right now.
Okay. Well, listen, if by chance you actually come in contact with that bear that you're trying to track down with your radio collar, just give me a call.
Okay.
We're talking with Lynn Rogers, who's with the Wildlife Research Center in Ely, Minnesota, and as well as working on the North American Bear Center. Perhaps we'll hear from you shortly. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
And for the first time in months, we managed to get through a newscast without having to report on some kind of devastating weather event. So enjoy the nice weather while we've got it. And that's the news. This is a special edition of the Wild Side News as we take an in-depth look at efforts to do something with a disaster left by Hurricane Katrina 8 months ago. As every American is well aware, things have not gone well at any point in this saga. And as residents try to put their lives back together, they are buried in mounds of red tape, making the recovery from the mounds of broken homes, lives, and neighborhoods just that much worse. We talked with Daryl Malik Wiley, who based his work with the Sierra Club from New Orleans. When we last talked with Daryl, Katrina had swept into the city. He was driven out and gave us his assessment of the damage that wrecked the coastal region. Well, he's back on the ground in New Orleans with a special perspective on the rebuilding, and we now shift our attention to New Orleans, where Daryl will bring us up to the minute on what's happening post-Katrina.
For those of us who are fortunate enough to not be affected by these devastating storms that seem to be wreaking havoc across America in various places, whether it's in Northern California or in the Midwest or in Tennessee, the East Coast has had their share, but of course the storm of all storms is Katrina. Katrina stands alone in terms of its devastation and the capacity for the United States to effectively deal with this. It's a huge, huge, historic storm. Well, when the storm happened back in September of last year, I was fortunate enough to talk with someone who really has his feet on the ground in that area, because he works with the Sierra Club in Baton Rouge and New Orleans and throughout actually the entire coastal area. And at that particular time, he was away from his home and didn't really know what had happened to his home. Daryl Malik Wiley, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be with you, Sydney.
Well, what did happen, Daryl?
Well, so much that it's hard to put it all in just a few words. When last time we talked, I was in San Francisco for the big Sierra Club Summit and came back, flew back from San Francisco to Houston, where I originally evacuated, and then went back and stayed in Baton Rouge for 4.5 weeks. I was out of my house for 6.5 weeks. I and my wife were one of the lucky ones in that our house did not flood, but there was a mandatory evacuation, so nobody was allowed in the city until early October. Through my work with the Sierra Club, I got a press pass for Sierra Club magazine and went into New Orleans about 2.5 weeks after the storm in September.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very chilling, surrealistic coming back to this very vibrant town that I left just 2.5 weeks before, and nobody there. Signs of flood water, you know, up on buildings. I came to my house, and there was a fluorescent yellow X painted on my house. And I later learned that every house had that fluorescent, some color painting on it that signified who came by to look at the house, if they entered the house, what date they did it, and if they found any bodies. So that was very chilling, to say the least.
That's right.
And then have sort of moved beyond that and just been extremely busy trying to talk about environmental issues related to Katrina, and there's loads of them.
Well, you really have a perspective, and I'd be just curious, this is your town, give the listeners a heads up on where you see things at right now in terms of this process. I mean, it's such a huge thing, but so give us whatever you want to talk about at this point.
Right. Myself, like I think everybody, watched the television right after the storm and saw all those images and really the inability, inaction of the federal government. And here we are 8 months later, and in some cases we still see that inaction by the federal government. FEMA has got so much red tape and different hoops that people have to jump through to try and get aid or trailers or support in moving back to the city. There have been plan A through Z, I think, so far. And every time you turn around, there's something new to really upset people as far as FEMA not being willing to pay for this, because it didn't happen by the storm, but yes, it was destroyed, but it was by the wind, and just all sorts of bureaucratic red tape. And the concern, I think, that a lot of folks in New Orleans have raised, they're talking about now in funding in the range of $18 to $20 billion, which seems like lots of money. I know if I had that much money, I'd probably not be worrying about being an environmental activist. But in the scope of things, that's just a drop in the bucket as to what's needed to make the city of New Orleans and Gulf Coast back normal. The people need to understand, all the flooding in the city of New Orleans was not caused by the hurricane. It was caused by flaws in the Corps of Engineers levee system that failed. So all of the flooding in New Orleans was preventable if the Corps of Engineers would have done its job properly in the past. And so, to my way of thinking, the federal government failed New Orleans residents, St. Bernard residents, by allowing this flooding to happen. Therefore, they should make everybody 100% whole again. And that's, we're very far from that. They're talking about pennies on the dollar as far as property values on helping people get their lives back together. And then you add on top of that all the environmental insults, and it's just very frustrating, and lots of angry folks down here.
Well, I don't blame people. I mean, it's a It's a huge disaster. I can't think of anything that compares in my lifetime to what happened. It's a city that's taken out. When you sort of visualize the city, how much of it would you say is really at this point dysfunctional?
Right, 80% of Metro New Orleans, Orleans Parish flooded, and of that, I'd say maybe 60% is still non-functional. There are large sections of town that if you go there at night, there aren't street lights. The Holy Cross neighborhood, which is part of the lower Ninth Ward, the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association I'm working with, people are not allowed to stay in their homes overnight because there's still a curfew in that area. And that's causing all sorts of problems because we're seeing not only the devastation by the flood, but we're seeing human greed coming into play. There's been a rash of architectural theft. You know, many homes in New Orleans are beautiful wood structures with lots of interesting architectural details. And there's almost been a systematic looting of some parts of towns where one day every fence, cast iron fence will be gone, and the next day all the shutters are gone and then windows. And it's with the Holy Cross neighborhood, it's especially hard because people aren't allowed to live there to watch over their property, and the police have not been protective enough of the area.
This special edition of the Wildside News returns following this short break.